and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. This is episode 105, recording on the 11th of August, and I am Tom Francis. With me here today are...
Graham Smith.
And...
Chris Thurston.
And you two have both been to exciting places.
I have.
I haven't. Where have you been?
I've been to SausageCon, Germany. Or Gamescom, as it's known to people who don't go there and imagine that it's a beautiful land full of video games and not... A sweaty land.
Full of sausages.
An enormous convention centre, larger than any other building I've ever been to, with 400,000 other people inside it.
And tiny beers.
And many tiny beers in cricket bats.
In cricket bats?
Well, sometimes it's like a cricket bat. Oh, you drill holes in it.
Like a sort of flight of kolsch.
Yes.
Kolsch being the local beer, which is served in smaller glasses for some reason.
Yeah, Kolsch is good. Kolsch is the best thing about it. That and the enormous Gothic cathedral in the centre of town. Also, video games!
I was going to say, as a vegetarian, Graham, how much of the Gamescom experience do you really feel like you've had?
Well, you do go to parties and there are just sometimes plates of raw sausage there. and that's never happened anywhere else in the world. But yeah, it's fine. It's fine. They've got vegetables there. Chips, mainly, but, you know. Also, video games.
How about them?
I saw lots of video games, and although there was nothing super surprising, like, that's the kind of way that Gamescom works. It's often, hey, the stuff that you saw at E3 or was announced at E3, now you just get 25 minutes to play it, or now you get just a 25-minute gameplay presentation, at least, rather than a more cinematic trailer. And it was really good for that, and there were lots of nice things that I saw. One being Mirror's Edge Catalyst.
Yeah.
I'm a fan...
Those are my two opinions on that.
I'm a fan of the original Mirror's Edge. And that doesn't mean that I'm blind to its many, many faults. But I feel like people focus on the faults and that game gets a bad rep sometimes. And that
gets a bad rep for its crippling flaws.
Yeah. And that makes me want to support it more. But I was...
That's not how criticism works.
I was worried that with Catalyst, because the first Mirror's Edge wasn't a huge financial success, that they would emphasise the parts of it that were a bit bunk. Because the bits that were bunk were rubbish in part because they didn't gel with what the game was trying to be. It's a first-person parkour game, which is about movement and exploration and puzzling out how are you going to get to from A to B when A is on the ground and B is 600 feet directly up, and then sticking in a bunch of QTE combat and boss fights and stuff like that didn't really work. But I was worried that they would, you know, make the combat more combat-y, because people like combat, and in doing so make it less Mirror's Edge-y. But they haven't. They've done the opposite of that. It's set in an open world now. It's just as pretty as it was before. It's much more focused on movement. There's a little bit of grapple hook in action, which
grapple
is nice.
I'm excited about this.
And there's no guns now.
The enemies have guns.
The enemies still have guns. You can't pick them up. And it's much more about being able to very quickly take down the enemies rather than getting close to the enemies and then having to wait for their gun to flash red for a fraction of a second and then press the button to disarm them to get the weapon to hit them. And in the demonstration I saw, it was just 25 minutes of them playing it, starting off in an open world city, picking a route through it, dodging guards, swinging between buildings, leaping across rooftops, all that good stuff, and then getting to a skyscraper and going inside it without any load screen whatsoever, and then working out how to get to the top of this large atrium inside the skyscraper. And there was a point at the end where there was a brief cutscene, and then you were spotted, and now guards were chasing you. And that I don't mind. I enjoyed the tension in the first game of running away from people. And then when it came time to, they were in your path and you either had to find a way around them or hit them, almost all of them were positioned in front of a plate glass window, so you could very easily kick them through it. And that looked really satisfying. The part of it which still seems a bit dubious is the story, or maybe more accurately, the characters. First game starred a man called Jackknife and had a head of security who wore a suit, but who was also a former wrestler. And they were not the greatest written or developed characters in the world. This one, I think that the man who speaks in your earpiece is called Echo. It makes me dislike him already.
Is he a dolphin?
I hope so. That would make me like
what a
it
twist.
More. And then the first guy that you meet is this. He's just been designed by an art director to be a prick. Like, he's wearing
the terrible fate to befall.
He's wearing a vest with a hood up, and he's got sunglasses on all the time, even though it's at night. And he's wearing elbow-length fingerless gloves. And as he talks to you, he doesn't look at you. He just kind of paces back and forward, like swaggering, and then making fun of you. And then over the course of the next half-hour-long mission, he's piping up in your earpiece as well to whine and bitch about the fact that you got to go on the mission and he didn't.
Hooray, it's I like, love that.
Hooray!
I love being complained at by idiots.
I can't wait till this jerk-o inevitably betrays me 4 yes. hours into this game.
It's so set up. They really struggled both times to sort of live up to how cool the world is. Like, I feel like Mirror's Edge's plot would have been unnoticeably mediocre in a different game. But because I was so in love with the city and just love the look of Faith, and she just looks so fucking cool and mysterious and interesting, I wanted to know anything about her. And then as soon as I found anything about her, I'm like, oh, come on. That's terrible. That's just really dull. And all her friends are idiots and everyone looks stupid. it felt like the plot was just sort of like from a different game, and it didn't live up to how cool that world is. And it sounds like you're probably going to do that again. Even before you saw it, and we were just going by like the E3 reveal, the sort of going back to her childhood and stuff and showing how oppressed she is by the society just seemed very, very conventional for someone who looks so kind of just cool and like, I don't know.
It's like there's a huge dignity to that world in a weird way. Like, it's a believable dystopia in the sense that it looks like you'd actually kind of want to live there and not scrape past the surface of it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, not Blade Runner, but something where you can actually imagine society looking like that and also being horrible.
Yeah.
But it's the idea of what a horrible society actually is so childish that it kind of really, it's a bit like a world where, like, grown-ups built all the amazing skyscrapers, even if they built them for evil. But then the world is now exclusively populated by 22-year-old wankers who, like, inherited it. You know what I mean? It's an argument between, you know, stylish people with cool hair, and therefore it loses so much of the dignity it might have had.
Including the CEO of EA, is there?
Yeah, exactly.
I couldn't tell. Like, he looked, I swear, much older in the Gamescom demo than he did at E3. And I can't tell if it was
the president of EA or the villain of the game.
The villain of the game. Okay. I couldn't tell whether they changed him to avoid that criticism.
Oh shit, everyone noticed. or maybe he noticed. Yeah. No one had told him before.
Sent an email. But it's frustrating. I mean, obviously it's fiction, so they can do whatever they want, but they weren't tied into anything that forced them to make the same kind of jerk holes that they made the last time. Like, there's plot reasons from Mirror's Edge 1 that would have allowed them to, without spoilers, start fresh. And as it turns out, they're calling this a reboot rather than a sequel, in which case they're saying we've jettisoned that game, basically. That game may as well no longer be canon. We're starting again. And if that's the case, why do you look at the character of Jackknife from Mirror's Edge 1 and think, that's what we need. We need another guy like that. It really angers me, as you can tell.
The fighting stuff. So we all saw a trailer that was a much cut-down version of what you saw, I think, that had the fighting at the end of it where she pivots on things and kicks people through stuff.
Yeah.
And it looked really good. It looked way, way better than Mirror's Edge's combat. And in fact, at the time, most of my complaints about that game were very specifically the things they've sold here. Like, when I have momentum, I don't want that to be lost because I didn't press the combo button at the right time.
Yeah.
And now it looks like it's all based around that momentum and using it. The only thing I didn't like was that a couple of times, there's a guard with a gun, like, 10 meters away, and she's got to get towards him, and so she just, like, runs and jumps off stuff, and the guard is just firing directly at her the entire time, and there's no kind of... I think once she gets shot, but it has no real effect, and then the rest of the time they're just shooting, and it has no effect on her at all, presumably because it's supposed to be missing. And they did say something before about, like, when you're in free flow or something. Like, there's a special sort of game state for when you've successfully chained together a bunch of moves without screwing anything up, then bullets literally can't hit you. They're just completely invulnerable. Hmm.
Faster than bullets.
I think that's one of the game's really most troubling assumptions, that, or the plot-wise at least, is that parkour is magic. I mean, the original game, without spoiling, it really trades really heavily on the notion that parkour is some sort of like dangerous magic that could be used against the government, where it's really just jumping.
I saw, well, this is another thing I saw while I was in Germany. I was in my hotel room at like 10 o'clock at night, writing stuff up, and turned on the TV, and it was in German, dubbed, but there was a Hollywood movie on in which some people used dance. And I think in order to stop the development of a skyscraper.
I play that game.
Oh,
so, I mean, that's a common thing in fiction, that, you know, some things just can be magic within the rules of a world without anyone ever really acknowledging we live in a fantasy magic world.
Isn't that what like, all of the Step Up movies are about? And
it could have been one
also
of the
that Jessica Alba one. Like, in every one of these, they... It's about, like, a bunch of people who dance, and then some terrible, evil corporate person comes in and wants to destroy the place where they dance and build a new place, and so they have to dance to stop that from happening. we can solve this with the one thing we know how to do.
This is in German, and I watched, like, an error of it, but there were scenes in which they launched smoke grenades into a rich person's party and then danced wearing gas masks, while all the rich people looked appalled and frightened and ran away from the scary dancing people. But then, at the end, after it turned out that head corporate evil guy's daughter was one of the dancers, they did a dance that was so good that even the corporate guys liked it, and one of the corporate guys started to dance, and then they shook hands and everyone was happy.
Okay, why isn't this the plot of Mirror's Edge?
That would be better.
Right,
that game is such awesome parkour that the head of EA has to do parkour as well.
Yeah, that game should open with like a local real estate developer buying Faith's fucking parkour gymnasium. And then she goes on a cross-city quest to prove how rad parkour is.
Can you imagine, though, the parkour
equivalent... By kicking people through windows.
The parkour equivalent to the scene where, like, the uptight suit sort of can't help but tap along to the music. It's like, the uptight suit can't help but, like, slightly climb on his chair and carefully back down again.
No, that's how you kill him at the end. He doesn't realise how dangerous it is. It's so easy. And he's like, I can do that. And then he, like, falls to his death immediately. At the end.
Sounds like a good game.
I would play this. I saw 26 games or something. So I'll talk about two others, and then if there's anything else you guys want to ask me about, that's fine.
Yep.
One of the other ones I played was Mad Max, and I haven't seen Fury Road.
What?
I know. And previous times that I'd seen Mad Max, I thought it looked a little bit guff. It looked like a game, an open-world game that didn't have any particularly strong ideas of its own. Its desert wasteland looked somewhat empty, and they were doing stuff, and I'm not even sure if this is still in there, in which you had to, for example, get water in order to drink and survive in that wasteland, which could have been interesting, but just didn't really gel with... Well, it's made by Avalanche, and they were suggesting that they wanted to make an action game, and it looked just kind of boring and empty. But I played it for half an hour at Gamescom, and I had a great time with it.
You said that in the Crane Crowbar uncertainty.
Yeah. Well, I was sort of surprised at myself. It starts off with, like, the first thing they showed or let us play with was just car customization stuff, and that was kind of cool. You could flick through and you could change chassis and engine and paintwork, and also choose what kind of weapons you wanted, and so I stuck knives on my wheels, flamethrowers on the side of my car, and gave the little sidekick guy who hangs off the back of your car an explosive harpoon gun. But right away, oh, and I painted it pink. So right away, I'm pretty happy with that. And then they drop you in the open world, and they say, okay, there's a mission on your mini map. You can go to that mission, but you don't have to. And so I didn't. I went and drove off. I
bet they're like, shit.
I set a waypoint for a nearby balloon, and the balloons operate... I don't know if this is a thing from Fury Road, if there are hot air balloons in that film.
Nope.
But balloons operate similar to the radio towers in Far Cry 3. Basically, the things that you capture and you send up, and they unlock a new area of terrain. In the sense of they highlight all the icons from that area of terrain on your map. And so I set my waypoint to there, and I drove off. And as I was driving, a convoy drove past, And convoys are just a thing that drive all over the world. They got a giant truck that's at the lead and like six or seven cars speeding along behind it full of lunatics. And the challenge is to destroy the truck without getting killed by the lunatics. And so I decided I would do that. And they happened to be passing through a canyon at that moment, which gave me the opportunity to speed up a hill adjacent to the road, hit a boost and hit a ramp at the top and go flying into the air and land perfectly alongside them, which felt great. The cars feel really nice. They're really heavy and grippy, which I like. And then just had a really fun combat experience fighting against these other cars as people clambered from their vehicles onto my vehicle. As whenever you're aiming, you're technically controlling the sidekick guy at the end. And it's got the most beautiful explosions I think I've ever seen in a game. You fire the harpoon gun at a car next to you and it immediately explodes and the physics cause it to like leap into the air and spin. And as it spins, the flames from the explosion seem to be almost like dragged physically in the wind. They're not like a single ball of fire, but actually distinct flames coming off different parts of the car, and that looks incredible. And as we're kind of speeding through the wasteland, and I'm battling these other cars, there's a button that allows your car to like shunt to the side, which is obviously
car strafe.
Yeah, car strafe, just a little bit, which is useful if you've got knives on your wheels like you did. So it's a little bit like almost like chariot racing as you're speeding through the desert and there's dust get flipping up, and you know, chariots had flamethrowers outside.
That's where chariots of fire comes from.
And then another open world dynamic event happened, which is a sandstorm, which I understand is the thing that happens in Fury Road. And it has lightning, like, cast. So, like, visibility drops to nothing as I'm racing with this convoy through the desert, except for flashes of lightning through the smoke, which is fucking beautiful. And then it, like, strikes the car next to me, which immediately explodes and goes up in flames and stuff like that. And it's like, this is great! I just drove into the nothingness for 4 minutes and, like, 3 minutes later was then in this in like great action sequence. It actually all hung together really well. And then, you know, I eventually crashed and my car was damaged and I had to get out and I had to fight on foot for a little bit. And then I got to the hot air balloon and I died. And then I respawned back at a base and there was some plot stuff and I, whatever. Oh, it seems normal gamey stuff, which I'm sure will be fine. But the car combat, cars and fighting don't often go that well together in games, I find. But if I guess I should have trusted Avalanche a little more, because they did it well with Just Cause by allowing you to surf along the roof of your car, hop between cars and grapple between cars.
I watched a playthrough of this where it sounds like it was the same section, and the guy had the harpoon thing on his car, and but he did the mission, and it did look quite fun to drive, but the actual, like, once he got to the mission, he had to destroy a certain number of cars up front, and they were just sort of, like, someone were just kind of parked, and someone were just in, like, short patrol routes and stuff, and him trying to take them out was just kind of awkward after a while, because it wasn't a convoy chase, like, there was no journey to it. They were just stuck in this one arena, so they had to keep stopping and then reversing and then trying to get up enough momentum to ram them, and that looked a bit awkward.
See, I was hoping that they wouldn't do stuff like that, because, well, how do you feel, Chris, about the tank combat in Batman? I can't remember now.
Have defended it, but I think it's bad.
Game journalist, everybody.
Because that seems like the fact that you're a tank that can, you know, strafe quite heavily seems like probably the only viable solution to car combat in closed spaces where you can't
be, you have to be working out momentum. But I mean, it's okay, it's just like not as developed as the other parts of the game, and any attempt they've made to, we talked about this in the podcast before, any attempt they made in that case to make it as elegant as the game's other challenge systems just doesn't really work. You can see the bones of it, but it doesn't really function because, again, you're a big cumbersome tank dodging projectiles for too long in a box, which I think that was my concern about Mad Max as well. Like the sort of like Rage had that problem. The sort of demolition derby style driving in circles, trying to kill the other cars. Stuff gets really dull really fast. Whereas, yeah, what I wanted it to be was a chase, right? Because, I mean, that's the point of Fury Road, actually, is it's very linear, literally. It is a road, and it goes in one direction, and it goes in another direction, and that's the film. You know, there's no bit where all the cars drive around in a big pit trying to hit each other.
I mean, I still, I guess, have the concern that maybe that's it. Maybe I saw the two dynamic events they got in the open world, and they just happened to happen when I was playing it, and I got lucky. But then at the end of the day, if it is just convoys and sandstorms all the way down, then I would play that for a good few hours and have fun with it.
It reminds me of the Far Cry thing of, like, you know, everyone's kind of got the same Far Cry story, because it's like, oh my god, and then the tiger came out and they killed the guy. And every single Far Cry 3 and 4 story is a variant on that, basically. But there's still enough room at the fringes for kind of interesting mad stuff to happen.
Yeah.
So I guess it's just what the rest of that stuff is in that open world. If you just always drive through a sandstorm on your way to unhitch a balloon, then maybe it would lose its shine more quickly.
Do you know how it works with Just Cause 3? Are they two separate teams, or is there overlap?
I assume it must be two separate teams, because I also played Just Cause 3 against them, and that's also a big-ass open world game, so I can't imagine how they would have done both with any kind of overlap. Their presentation, though, was not the greatest for Just Cause 3. Mm. Because while Mad Max just said, hey, here's the open world, go nuts, Just Cause has actually done that at previous press events. We've already played it for like 3 hours. So at Gamescom, they instead gave you half an hour to play with like little challenge maps, two which were destruction challenges where you scored points for blowing things up, and there were like tanks and helicopters around the environment that you could go find, and the 90 second timer didn't begin until you destroyed the first thing, so you could explore a little bit and choose an angle of attack. And the other one was skydiving challenges where you like started leaping off a helicopter and there were just rings in the sky that you could like fly through. These are things that if I owned the game, I would never once play. Someone would play them, and they're perfectly fine, but I would never play them. Although, what it did give me the opportunity to do, because I had never played the game before, was muck around with the parachute and the grapple hook and that sort of stuff for the first time. And the wingsuit, yes. Which all felt good. They seem to me even more super heroic than Just Cause 2. Like, the wingsuit, especially, is just... You can just fly now, more or less, forever.
Well, what does it feel like when you're free-falling? Because I had a real problem with Just Cause 2 with the falling speed. Like, when you're not using a parachute, your falling speed is still absurdly slow. Like, if you saw him plummet out of the sky, you'd have to just sit there and watch for a while to get the ground.
I don't know, actually. Like, the skydiving thing, that was, I was using a wingsuit, and I never experimented to, like, see. The Far Cry 4 thing was kind of hilarious when we were playing it co-op and, like, watching you jump off the just slowly drift like a plastic bag across the ground.
I didn't really mind in Far Cry 4, and maybe because it's first person, or maybe because I was wingsuiting all the time, and, but Just Cause 2, although, like, I spent all my time with a parachute, obviously, and the grappling hook. What is it called? It's not actually a parachute, is it? It's paragliding. But the fact that if I didn't activate my parachute, I would already fall so slowly, kind of robbed it of its thrill. Like, the thrill is defying gravity, right? It's cheating death. It's doing these amazing things in these situations that should be incredibly dangerous. But actually, A, it doesn't feel dangerous if you don't do that thing because you fall so slowly. And B, although there is fall damage and you will die, you can just grapple onto the floor and that saves you, even though that makes no sense. I don't really mind that it doesn't make any sense, but it robs heights of their danger. And I'd like it if it felt like heights were dangerous, basically.
I'll tell you one thing. I, at one point, accidentally wingsuited into the side of like a radio tower, and the radio tower exploded and it caused like a chain reaction that lasted like 45 seconds as the radio tower was part of an array of three other radio towers and all the bridges between them and the entire building thing. I just lay there on the ground as like a ragdoll model watching all these things.
Mission complete.
They'll brew the day they made that out of chopsticks.
Explosive chopsticks.
And the third game that I'd like to talk about is called Planetoid Pioneers, which I'd never heard of before, but it's made by Data Realms, who are the guys that did Cortex Command. Cortex Command being a side on physics-y base building game in which you have to build defenses against waves of enemy aliens and or robots as they try and get into your base and you're like mining things out. And it had, it was really interesting, but a bit broken and buggy when it was released after years and years of early access development before early access was ever a thing. Planetoid Pioneers is their next game, and it's playing with similar ideas, but has incredible tech behind it. And it's kind of like Spore crossed with Garry's Mod crossed with Scribblenauts. The story is that you've crashed on a planet. You have like a matter ray that allows you to suck up debris and objects, and then according to any blueprints that you've unlocked, spray that matter out again to form those blueprints. And all matter is split up into water, carbon, silicon, or metals, which determines the kinds of things that you can make. And then you're on this planet, and the zoom is such that you can zoom out to the point where you can see the curvature of it. And there's a few open caves near where you've landed. And you can go into those caves and explore and find new materials and aliens and that sort of stuff. Now, this is the setup to 1,000 crafting and survival games that are on early access. But the interesting things about behind this are, first of all, that none of it's procedural. It's all handmade. Second of all, it'll ship with the tools that they used to make the game. And those tools allow you to create your own textures, creatures, guns, planets, vehicles, the animations for any of those things, and the Lua scripts that attach to those things in order to determine their behaviors. And then when you've created your octopus creature or your gun or anything, you save it as a PNG file, and that PNG file contains everything that the game needs in order to render that thing in-game. Like, it compiles the PNG such that it's even got the Lua scripts in there. And so they showed me, for example, their development forum where they've got 300 or 400 private beta testers making stuff for fun using their tools. And he just dragged a squid from the browser window onto the game. The squid appeared in the world and as an articulated physics object with limbs and stuff that fell to the ground. And the idea is that the starter planet that you land on will take 2 or 3 hours to kind of play through as you explore the caves and get enough materials in order to build your own spaceship that you can launch out into space. And then you'll be able to explore a galaxy of other planets that are either created by the developers or downloaded from the Steam Workshop and created by other people. You can install a bunch of other people's planets and then you can go crash land on their planets and they might be completely new texture sets with completely new weapons and completely new creatures and stuff like that, all with their own behaviors in them.
Did they talk at all about how they would filter that in terms of, or how they would prioritize it? Because the thing was, the way Spore did it was with Sporecasts, where people could create their own curated feeds of that stuff, and that worked really, really well. As long as you knew about it and as long as you went and subscribed to some good ones. And so the PC Gamer one, I would just look at, basically, really easy to do, I just looked at what was popular, like new and rising creations, and they were fucking incredible. I just clicked yes on all of them. And so if you subscribe to the PC Gamer Sporecast, you've just got a world full of incredible creatures that just put Max's stuff absolutely to shame. Like, every time you came across a shitty-looking, awful creature, like, oh, that's Max's.
I'm almost certain that's just default functionality within Steam Workshop, that you can just create collections of mods, and then you can subscribe to those collections. Huh. So technically, PC Gamer or RPS could create their own curated collections of these things that people could just subscribe to in order to
sign me up for Dong World.
Yeah. There will be many penises made.
Part of the Dong Galaxy collection.
After describing this stuff and showing off some of the tools, he went into the cave system of this little planet that they built and showed off some of the creatures that they'd created. And because it's all physics-driven, like, the first creature he came across was like a spindly alien plant arm that just whatever comes close to it, it can grab a hold of and then swing around and smash into the walls. So he kind of like rolled his buggy down a hill so that this thing grabbed the buggy and slammed it around until it broke and then threw it away and that sort of stuff. And then in order to get past that, he used his grappling hook, because you've got a grapple hook and a jetpack by default. And the grapple hook you can also use as a tether. So he like attached the tether to one end of the spindly plant and then like attached it to the cavern roof so the spindly arm couldn't move anymore.
Of the games you mentioned so far, do any not have a grappling hook? Mad Max, Just Cause 3, Mirror's Edge, and this.
Mad Max might not have a grappling hook.
Well, it's got the harpoon thing, right? That's kind of not quite the same. But
I don't
think count, Tom. Well, what's your taxonomy of grappling
hook? I feel like you need to be able to swing from it, so I guess not.
Okay.
It probably does, and I just didn't see it in the demo. It's Avalanche, it would be presumably pretty easy for them to tick a box in their engine and make Max swing
Models
around.
Will put it in immediately.
And then after that, he started spawning creatures in the cave just to show their behaviours and stuff. So he dropped this little Robbie the Robot type guy who kind of marched back and forth. And as you got close to it, he fired flamethrowers that just destroyed the player. And if you shot at him, the damage modelling is... He's made up of 1,000 triangles, basically. So the damage modelling is locational, and it takes chips out of the specific areas that you're shooting. So you can... They don't have health points. They will continue to work, if they're robots at least, for as long as they have limbs that allow them to move. And if you shoot him at the waist and cut him in half or whatever, he will still try and move around, still use his arms as flamethrowers to try and kill you and that sort of stuff. And then they do interesting things with the modelling of this. So he, after popping down Robbie the Robot, popped down this snake robot. It's maybe 4 or 5 limbs long with spinning metal gears, and the spinning metal gears were how it kind of rolled around, but the spinning metal gears were also sharp enough that the snake just raced towards Robbie the Robot and just ground him to dust, basically. Just like polygon by polygon, broke him down. And that looked really cool. And then the developer gave himself a freeze ray, which he used to defeat the grinding gear snake, because it freezes the gears so that they can't turn anymore. So he couldn't move or grind him to paste. And the interactions between those things and the physics of it and the scope for players to create stuff could make for something really interesting. I'm not sure whether the developers are making that interesting thing, but they've made some great tools. It'll be really interesting to see if it manages to capture the attention of that Gary's Mod style audience that could just make all these things in 2D and go to town.
What's your actual objective?
They didn't talk about a specific long game objective. The short term in those 2 or 3 areas was get enough materials together that you can build stuff, survive, and blast off from this planet. Beyond that, they didn't talk about where their other planets might go. I'm not sure that they know or care. I think they're expecting that it's going to be mostly about user-made stuff. And so even if they do have 6 planets that they've made themselves that form some sort of arc or storyline, players will spend most of their time just dicking around on each other's planets. And it'll have 4-player co-op, local co-op. Yeah. Online multiplayer is not confirmed.
Cool.
Huh. I guess it's like Spore, where it seems like such a multiplayer thing, but it's actually not multiplayer. How was International, Chris?
It was really good. It was really good. I'm very tired now. So I was at the Dota International for 6 full days last week. I thought it was going to be less packed than previous internationals was, because previous internationals were 3 days, 4 days long, very intense. And it turns out that's not how that works. It's just 6 really, really intense days. But there's a bunch of different angles on it. One is that the game itself was in a much healthier place than it was last year, so the games were more exciting, they lasted a little bit longer. Very stable metagame in some ways, but with enough kind of variety. and a scene that is as close as I've ever seen it. Like, it just upsets all the way down from, like, the everyone's favourite team in the world. The team everyone thought was going to smash the entire thing, finishing in the middle of the pack. Winners, not totally unprecedented, but, like, the second place was a team that came in through the wild card, which is, like, the hardest possible way to get into the international. You have to have come second in a regional qualifier, yet they went in and smashed it, despite being all really new, like, entire team made out of first-time internationalers. And they won, like, $2.8 million for their first go, which isn't bad. Yeah, amazing finale, really good games, really good atmosphere. The sides of it, I think, are probably more broadly interesting than the Dota that was played. Like, partly Valve stuff. Like, Valve, they spend half the year building this thing that runs over a couple of weeks, I guess, online, but in a real venue for about a week or less, that I asked them, like, you know, do you bring in external expertise, or do you design this yourselves? Where did you kind of learn to be stadium event showrunners? And apparently they do just do it themselves, which is kind of weird. And last year it showed in that it didn't really fit the venue, and it felt a bit off. Like, it wasn't a great setting for it. It was bigger than the previous venue, but less intimate to a fault. You know, people are further away from the screen and further away from things. And this year, the design of the thing, that they've said that designing for a live audience isn't that similar to designing a game. And it kind of showed that in the year that passed, I think they got much better access to the venue this time after proving that they could sell the entire thing out for 12 hours a day for as many days in the row as they want to do it. They got much better access to the space. But this year, it was easily the best setting for watching the game I've ever seen, with, like, rather than place the two teams kind of in booths adjacent to each other with a single screen above them and everyone facing that in that direction, like in a cinema, which doesn't really fit in, like, a pit-shaped sports arena. They did it so that the stage was in the shape of the Dota logo, which was cute, in the middle of the arena with the two pods facing each other with, like, screens around the pods to show some player information. And then hanging above the pods, this kind of, like, tapered square of screens. So they had a screen facing to all four sides of the arena, so wherever you were in the arena you could see a screen, and above that another four screens that showed, like, an enlarged mini map and stats and stuff. And then hanging in the center of this massive apparatus Valve built custom for this thing were a set of projectors that faced down, which by default the kind of Dota logo stage was white, but they were projecting it with really high quality, high resolution projection mapping. So during the games it had, like, the texture of, like, an animated Dota map, so it looked like the two teams were sat where the pods were with the bases, and between them was, like, a kind of constricted version of the map. But then they also did, like, animated projection mapping onto the stage itself, so that when one team used, like, an ultimate ability on the other team, it would actually shoot from one booth to the other, which is, you know, there's actually no reason to look at the floor during esports events, to the extent that I didn't notice that for a long time until someone pointed it out, because you're obviously looking up at the screens rather than down at the floor between the booths. But again, it kind of demonstrates, like, they had, like, a million different, like, new ideas, and somehow they managed to do a bunch of them. I don't know how many they did, but so it felt much higher production value. Like, they opened with an orchestra performing the Dota theme live with a chorus and everything else. Ended with Deadmau5, which happened. I think it didn't sell to people online, but it was actually kind of fun when you were there, because it was so kind of deafening, and, like, why is this happening? Why is there a man with a big electronic Mickey Mouse head rocking out in front of us after someone just won $6.6 million? And, like, a much better experience around the place as well. It felt more like, you were talking about earlier, Graham, and you made the comparison of Wimbledon. I think that's right. Like, it felt like Dota Wimbledon or Dota Golf, where you could go out to the merchandise shop outside, which was in its own building. Because in TI3, my first international, it was a stall with an enormous queue, just a stand inside the venue. TI4, my second international, it was a big tent outside the venue. TI5... a warehouse, like, a minute away down the road.
Like, no next year, it'll just be in a different city.
Well, I suggested, like, it's almost its own event now, to the extent that it pulls crowd away from big games, which is kind of interesting. But outside near the where the secret shop was, they had, like, another 40-foot screen outside that was just showing the games in front of a lawn. It was a beautiful day in Seattle, like, really gorgeous, and sat out there. And that was free. Like, if you wanted to just wander past and you remember the public, right, you wanted to just sit down and watch Dota, you could. And that was the sort of extent to which they were allowed to expand on the previous year. And that felt, you know, there were, you know, kids and stuff just wandering past to have a look. And that's a kind of good, it's a kind of nice message for the game, and it kind of gets that, what's happening out there out of this kind of insular arena setting.
So strange that they put in this enormous amount of work that seems so outside their skill set given that Valve runs on this policy of people can just do whatever they want and they work on whatever they want to work on, it's hard to believe that this huge team of primarily programmers and modelers and stuff would suddenly think, oh yeah, what I want to work on is organizing an event. The most difficult and strenuous kind of thing.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I'm pretty sure the guy who... I don't know if I'm getting this right, but I heard a rumor that the guy who has organized the Secret Shop, the merchandise stuff, 3 years running and redesigned it every year, is one of the guys from Valve whose picture is, you know, those like Valve man with Valve in head photos that load at the start of the podcast. Yeah. He's been at Valve so long, one of them is him. And yet now he does the Secret Shop between whatever else it is he does. And I know for a fact that in previous years it has been Valve staff doing everything. Because, you know, I remember one of my favorite TI stories was watching a guy get really shirty with a guy manning the queue for the voice actor signing booth. Like, because he didn't want to wait to get himself this stuff signed or whatever. And the guy he was getting shirty with was Mark Laidlaw, who wrote Half-Life. And I think if that guy had known who he was treating like, you know, just a member of staff, then he probably wouldn't have been quite so shitty. But this year I recognised a few people around, but I also saw some friends from Valve just walking around and enjoying it. So obviously, like, I have no idea. Like, and I know they bring in like an external company to actually like manufacture the merchandise and look after the online storefront for that. So there must be some, you know, outsourcing and stuff. But from talking to Eric Johnson, who's the sort of, I guess, the closest thing Dota has to a producer or a business manager, he gave the impression that it's very much a Valve gig, and that like in a week's time, they'll be sat down in an office at Valve talking about what did and didn't go well with the event, planning it for next year like any other project. Which is kind of interesting because, as you say, it is so far out of their wheelhouse in some ways, but I suppose it's permitted by their policy if people genuinely get excited about doing it and it's this big company policy. Like, you know, Gabe Newell showed up at the start to address the crowd and, you know, said that they do it because they just want to watch Dota and this is like their way of watching Dota in the highest possible quality, so they get an arena and they fill it with people and they make $64 million or something. The other thing I did while I was there was I got to try the Vive, because they had some demo stations and press appointments to try out the Valve's VR headset, which was great. It was fucking great, actually. Everything Graham said about it is true on a previous episode of the podcast. You know, it's there's so many things that are surreal about it, but because I'll move through them fairly quickly because a lot of it is what people have already talked about. But so I went to the room and I got, you know, a talk. It was HTC that had organised this. It wasn't Valve engineers, so I think that's a bit closer to consumer release. They've sort of taken over the promotion of the thing. But and they said, you know, do you have any experience with VR stuff? And I went, you know, yeah, we've used pretty much every Oculus Rift dev kit that's been in the office at some point or another, at which point he didn't seem to want to talk about VR anymore, because it felt like he'd been asked to ask that question, but asked not to say anything about Rift, which was kind of, which is a bit weird. But then, you know, puts the headset on me, and it starts off not that impressive, just looking into a white field and quite aware of the periphery of my vision and a little bit aware of pixelation, but I soon forgot about that. Then he puts the headphones on me, and then his voice switched from obviously being in real life, because at that point I think he moved over to a laptop to kind of keep an eye on what I was seeing and doing, and started talking to me through a microphone, which I then got in my ear as a voice over the game audio, which was so much like that bit in pretty much every shooter tutorial ever, where someone tests if your in-ear mic is working, that it was immediately immersively like being in a video game for the wrong reason, where I was like, because he was like, I'm talking like this crackly voice goes through, like, you know, okay, can you hear me all right? And then he moved across the room to hand me the controllers, and because the controllers are mapped in 3D space, it wasn't like picking up an Xbox controller when you're wearing a Rift, or you're reaching for something you know is there but yeah, can't see, because the controllers are fully mapped in 3D space, and for the purpose of that kind of introductory bit where you're standing in a white room from the Matrix pretty much, the controllers in the VR version of the controllers look like the real version of the controllers, the same size. I just saw these two controllers floating towards me because I can see the guy holding them. He says, you know, just reach out and take them. And there's something so strange about reaching out with an arm you can't see and then actually grabbing this physical object that feels like it should feel based on what you're seeing as well. And then because like it then projected the first thing was a really basic coordination thing about using one controller to like select a color from a color wheel, and on the thumb radial thumb pad, and then squeezing the trigger to like spit out a balloon from the end of that controller, like it was inflating these infinite balloons. And because the UI on the controller, in the UI on the virtual controller, is a one-to-one map for the physical controller in your hand, but it's got stuff projected onto it which doesn't exist on the black controller that you're actually holding, it's stupid how natural that immediately becomes. Like, you're pressing buttons that don't exist, really, but that your brain knows where they should be because the virtual version of them has them, and it's like, that's super fucked. Like, to skip ahead, that comes back into play. The only other demo I used that did involve the controllers as the controllers was this painting thing, where, again, you use the left one, the thumb wheel, to kind of rotate around colours and stuff, but then you point the right one at the left one, and it brings up this holographic display that you then use to flip between brush types and tools. And
it's the one in your left hand, the kind of easel.
Yeah.
It's like the back of your hand is one thing, the front of your hand is another.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like flipping it back and forth. It's just completely natural.
Yeah, it's weird that, and it's done as like a hologram interface, it's like an easel made of light, basically, and you kind of, and it isn't real, but at the same time, in those demos, you really feel like there's no processing time in your brain. I wonder if that's a big part of what presence is. Actually, your brain will accept things quite quickly that are completely impossible, right? Like having a dynamic holographic tool that magically floats above your hand. But your brain's just like, yep. And then I painted a giant three-dimensional Dota logo in pink neon flames, which is about as me a thing as I could do. And I knew the guy was watching, but I didn't care. And I like switched to like the magical rainbow sparkles one and surrounded by magic rainbow sparkles, but waving my arms around. The other demos I did, which I've been talked about, was the one where you're exploring the deck of a ship, and you can like swat little fishies out the way with your hands, and then a big whale comes. And because I knew a big whale was going to come, because you told me the story before, I was fucking terrified. They made me sign a waiver before I could do it.
Well,
which was just like, please don't do this demo if you were afraid of deep water spiders, massive things. And so
a really long javelin going through your eye, or this one bit where a guy saws your leg off.
I love the idea that sometime between, because I didn't have to sign that waiver, so sometime between GDC and March,
somebody died.
Some people just freaked the fuck out.
Maybe it's the difference between Valve demonstrating it and HTC demonstrating it as well. But anyway, so of course I signed the waiver because it's like, fuck, I want to go, and I don't really mind if it's scary, but we've spoken about this on the podcast before, like, I have a genuine, like, one of my things that does really get me is, like, massive things under the sea, or, like, massive things in space. Like, I get, it's that fear of the sublime thing, but it really kicks in. I think I used to be really afraid of water anyway, because of just not liking drowning. It's not a good thing. But water I can handle, but knowing that there was a big whale going to come, I was like, kind of like, look at the floor. Look anywhere else, like, try and make sure I didn't get surprised by it. And then the guy thankfully said, oh, if you just look to the left now. And I looked over and I could see it coming through the way. So it was okay, because it started small and got bigger. And then it arrived and it was huge. And, I mean, it's a big whale. Like, my response to it was exactly what my response would be to a big whale, which was sort of half animal terror, half the thought, that's a big whale.
I'm scared of whales also. And I found it strangely comforting. I sort of, like, because I knew I was safe, the fact that it was so convincing and so impressive and so huge, it was just kind of like felt like a rare opportunity to examine this thing that I'm terrified of without any danger. And so it's quite comforting in a way.
Yeah, I think I'm pretty kind of similar. Like, once it was there, I wasn't so bothered by it. My biggest fear was it suddenly being there and me having not had a chance to see it, because that's so much what the fear is like that sudden confrontation with something unfathomably large. I did duck physically when its tail swept past me. Like, that, I genuinely, like, started. After that demo, I did the cooking one, which I think people have mentioned, which is all about fulfilling recipes. And that
job simulator.
Yeah. And that is, people have spoken about before, it's about combining recipes in a pot while a robot is sarcastic at you, but I found it genuinely fun. Like, I accidentally broke the knife. There was a moment where I had to get a mushroom from the fridge, and I only needed one more mushroom, but I accidentally knocked out two mushrooms, and I caught one with one paddle hand. And, like, batted the other one back into the fridge with my other hand, like, without thinking about it. Like, I would probably do in real life if I was trying to, you know, stop something from dropping. And I think that demo was interesting because it was the only one that gave you hands in the world. And you have these sort of big, silly, cartoon, grabby hands, because all you can really do with the controller at the moment is, like, use the triggers to grab. Although there are pressure sensors on the sides of the controller, which will eventually be able to use to have more discrete finger movement. But that was the demo where it's like, I am aware that in real life I'm holding paddles, and these paddles vaguely translate to these, you know, stupid robot hands in the game. But that's probably, I think, one of the lines where the simulation blurs a little bit, or, you know, kind of like comes apart, but it was fun anyway, and it was sort of slapstick and interesting. Smashing eggs to get the egg yolk out for the ingredients was just, it's fun. Like, there's something nice about breaking shit and feeling like you're actually breaking it in the virtual world.
How many wires did it have? Which things were wired and which things weren't?
So, the controllers were wireless. But the headset was wired and will be wired.
Yeah.
So, because obviously it's pumping out really high definition from video and relaying all this information to these sensors and stuff. And that's something I was going to get onto actually, is that there was, backing up is perilous. And they have, so they have this thing called the chaperone system, which, you know, gives you this blue grid that appears if you're approaching the physical object in the room, like the wall. If you were spoken up before, that works. And when it comes out, that will also acknowledge where the controllers are, so it will stop you from bashing the controllers into the wall, because that is not currently the case. And at one point, I did accidentally punch the wall with the controller, because I was, in a demo I'll get on to talking about in a minute, one you guys haven't done, I think, I was reaching for something that was on a shelf with my paddle, and my head was far enough away from the real wall that the game didn't think to warn me that the wall was there, but in doing so, I just punched the wall with the paddle. I'm like, oh shit.
I punched myself in the face. Turns out my face is really there. That's not an illusion.
How did you manage that?
Well, I punched the visor, obviously. And it was partly because the visor sticks out further than you think. But I was, it was in the realistic job simulator thing. And I was picking up frying pans. And I was like, two things I was interested in is like, I could pick up a frying pan and I could hit other frying pans with it. If I hit a frying pan with my head, like move my head forwards, does it knock the frying pan out of the way? And it did. And then I thought, okay, what happens if I take the one in my hand, which I can control, and hit myself in the face with it? Because there can't be any consequences, because it's an imaginary frying pan. But it turns out there are consequences if your hand itself punches it in the face.
Maybe that's why
I really impressed the guys at Valve. I thought I was hot shit after that.
Maybe that's why they added that disclaimer. if you're afraid of punching yourself in the head. But they'll eventually change it so that the game will detect if the controller's about to get too close to the chaperone and show you the chaperone to warn you about that. But, like, I was talking to them about this afterwards, and I was like, what it needs is some sort of sensor in the cable that knows where the cable is in 3D space, so that you can look down and see what place the position of the cable is in. Because, like, I had to use, like, quite good spatial memory to untangle myself from the cable more than once, like, by rotating in the opposite direction of the direction. Mm-hmm. And obviously, because I could feel it start to snag around my legs, and then I'd go, like, all right, I'm going to walk around. To the point where I think I'd feel a little bit unsafe using it if there wasn't someone in the room who wasn't using it. Bit like recreational drugs. Like, you know what I mean?
Cable is a lot like drugs.
Well, you want somebody there who can go, ah, shit. Don't, you know, you're about to trip over.
Yeah.
Because that's a genuine danger regardless of the chaperone system.
I wonder if they could do something like a sort of mouse bungee, like one of those things that suspends a cable from above and, you know, could sort of pay it out and draw it in.
That I think would be the best solution at the moment, yeah. So anyway, to move on to probably the most interesting thing, which is this demo I saw, which I don't think you guys have seen, the Dota thing?
No.
The Secret Shop demo.
Maybe?
I didn't see anything Dota related.
Is it one where you shrink and grow?
Yes.
Yes.
Cool. So I think you probably have seen the early version of that. So this demo is set in a big hut belonging to the shopkeeper from Dota, and the light comes up and you're in this really dimly lit cabin surrounded by staff, and then the door opens and the shopkeeper walks in, and it's in sort of like full, you know, cinematic quality CG, so it's not just game assets, and he passes you a light, and you take the light and you can use the light to look around the room. And I think the purpose of that demo is just to show off detail, because it's not that interactive. Like, there's some things you can, the game will react to you if you poke at things, but like, I turned around and there's this little sort of wingless dragon creature, was one of the custom couriers from Dota, with a little fish in his mouth, and I kind of like waved the light at him, and he kind of cocked his head and like cooed at me. It was really cool. And then like I found the blink dagger from Dota, and as I put the light near it, it blinked somewhere else in the room. But there's this amazing sense of being the right size for the room at first, right? Like, you're in this, it's not a big place, but you're in there and you can walk around and look at all these really detailed manuscripts and all these items, cosmetic items and stuff from Dota hanging on walls, and like there's a little frog and stuff like that, and a little goblin on a magic carpet flying around the room in little circles, and like just tons and tons of detail. Like, I spent ages chasing the blink dagger around the room, and like I shone my light in the corner, and there was a divine rapier, which is the sort of the most sort of powerful in-game items in Dota, in a glass cabinet. You could sort of see it gleaming, and there's this, as a Dota nerd, this big kind of like you know, fan rush of kind of recognizing all the little details and stuff. But then scattered around the room were all these like white glyphs, and by touching them with the light, you shrank to the size of a borrower to kind of, and you'd be standing on the glyph wherever it was. And so like, the first time I did that, I stood on this manuscript, and suddenly the characters in the manuscript, which were, you know, detailed enough to read, were like huge below me, and I could see the diagrams and look up at the room, and it felt vast. And I heard this sort of like scuttling, thumping noise, and I turned around, and this massive spider was running towards me, so I panic squeezed the trigger again and came back to full size, and there's just a normal sized spider moving across the manuscript, which is a good trick, you know. But the thing is, until I was talking about this to you earlier, Graham, I didn't actually realize that shrinking and going back to normal size thing felt completely weirdly normal. Like my brain didn't flip out about the change in scale, like I knew what had happened straight away, or it was disorienting at first, but in an interesting way. Like, cause you'd think that'd be the kind of transition that VR would introduce you to for the first time, because it's not something you've experienced before in immersive first person. But actually, it didn't feel that. It was like a magic trick, but it didn't feel like I'd obviously done a scene transition or something. And then so I found a bunch of these spots, and, you know, in one case, I was suddenly on the window ledge next to that frog, and it poked its tongue out at me, and I started backwards, or, I found a gap in a wall, and a book fell off, and then I could see something moving in the darkness behind the wall, and then a big eye appeared in this crack in the wall and scuttled off again, belonging to a Dota hero, I think. And like a courier jumped out of a grate in the ground and scared me, and all sorts of this stuff. And then I found the window ledge, where you could actually get almost outside the hut. You could stand on the window ledge and look out in this sort of dark nighttime forest. And this sort of really interesting, palpable atmosphere of like being alone at night in the woods, and in the distance you could hear the sounds of a Dota game, like really faintly through the trees, like bolts of lightning and wolf howling and all these, like, they've just lifted sound effects from Dota, but it was weirdly effective at feeling like you're in this hut on the edge of the battlefield and it's all happening out there and you can't see any of it. And I imagine that's gonna be nothing to people, but for me it was that kind of weirdly, like, I mean, I play thousands of hours in this game, but I don't really think of it as an immersive thing. I don't really think of it as a place necessarily. It's a pitch with a load of different game systems operating on top of it, with an art style certainly, but not like, I couldn't imagine being there. And suddenly it was like I could hear like a Zeus alt going off in the distance, and kind of knowing what was happening in the distance, like the laughs of certain characters and stuff, was like, I don't know, it was really weirdly, I don't know, affecting necessarily. I didn't cry, but I thought I might, but that was pretty cool. And then towards the end of that demo, there was this sort of stomping sound, like it's really getting closer and closer and closer. You'd heard it at different points in the demo. And then I saw through like a gap in the wood panels of the roof, like just moving through the darkness, like what was obviously Roshan's silhouette. But Roshan in Dota is obviously just a big person on an isometric map, but it's sort of supposed to be, if you look at concept art, like Godzilla, basically, it's supposed to be this massive towering creature. And then it has a glowing orb on his forehead, and I could sort of see it in the darkness, and then he sort of turned to look at the cabin, and then there's this sort of like crash, and just the roof of the cabin getting torn off, and then there's sort of like, again, it's the whale moment where you look up and this creature's towering above you, and then hand come down, fade to black. You have to leave the demo booth now. But it's fucking rad. And I would own one just for stuff like that, I think. Like, interesting, well-produced
5-minute little
vignettes. Yeah, really just, because it works. Like, it works, and obviously there's a lot of technology involved in making it work and set up in a physical space. But it makes such an enormous difference to feel like you can explore, even with the cable issue, that the amount of things you can achieve with it seems so much more convincing than the Rift. Whereas I think the Rift will be amazing for cockpits and games where you're driving or flying something and you're sat down. As we've said a million times before, but I think we're comfortably at the point now where I can say, I don't think it really works for anything else. You know, it's a bit weird playing Skyrim with an Xbox controller and looking around at your head.
Yeah.
I think for walking around, because they haven't ever satisfactorily solved the problem of how do you walk around looking in different directions. So having more, you actually just walk around and look in different directions kind of solves that problem. And maybe it'll be room-sized experiences forever, but I don't know.
I want a game where, for the Vive, where it's a strategy game that takes place on a globe, and the globe like nearly fills the whole space that you have, and you can just grab it with your hands, rotate it manually, and zoom in by moving your head closer the old-fashioned way. And it's like DEFCON, or it's like something a bit more detailed than DEFCON, like with units you could actually see when you look closely enough, and just would feel like this action taking place on kind of a tiny scale relative to the globe, but a scale which you could, because of this, the ability to kind of get as close as you like to something, that you could examine in detail and sort of manage the whole thing. Because it, like, that's one, the one time I think a non-flat map could actually work, is if that's the whole game space, is you're just walking around this globe or spinning the globe around, that kind of stuff. And the 3D painting thing, I would love if, I'd love to use that input method to play a game like Supreme Commander or Homeworld and trace out the path of my units in 3D space. Say I want this bomber to come up over here and then swoop down like this and then go under there and here, like click, fire there, fire there, fire there, and then come back up through this way to dodge the enemy interceptors or whatever. Because you could describe so perfectly and so exactly what you want to happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, the game I want is essentially like the Battlestar CIC. Like, I want to be in a room-sized command and control center on a much bigger spaceship with screens detailing the battle outside, maybe a screen or something, so I can see outside, see the battle.
Someone's that's making that
flagship.
Game. Yeah, flagship.
Hmm. They're making it for VR.
Yeah.
I remember it was a Kickstarter, right?
Yeah.
I think that's when I saw a video of it. It did look fucking amazing, even then. And at the time, I wasn't thinking about VR, but yeah, it's the perfect room-sized VR game.
Just because, but I want, you know, all characters rushing in and out with reports from engineering, you know what I mean, that kind of thing.
That'd be, your plan makes no sense.
you direct the battle via like giant table-sized screens on the bridge, but you can also look out the window and see the battle happening in the distance outside the window of your spaceship.
Basically, I want Zap Brannigan Simulator in 2014. Just do lunges in my living room with a VR helmet. Maybe Riker Simulator instead. Maybe the tutorial.
In your glass-walled toilet on the bridge.
Yeah.
So I haven't been anywhere exciting, but I have another Indecision story to tell.
Hooray!
So my ongoing quest is to basically play through all of the interesting Endless Legend factions, because every time we talk about Indecision, we talk about how interesting the factions are and how unique they all are. And when I was struggling to get into the game, it was because I was playing basically the sort of standard-ish ones, or the one that's sort of, it's Space Marines, but they've forgotten their Space Marines and they were buried under the place, and now they're just kind of people with crossbows. there's not that much. They're quite science-y oriented, but their main like special perk was that they can declare a holy resource, which means they pick one of the types of resource, and then that becomes really important to them. They get buffed for it and stuff. But when you're just starting out, you have no idea what that
sounds
means.
Sounds like a toddler demanding something. Like, I've decided I'm really into this.
Yeah.
Diamond is my favourite.
But I thought I kind of knew that with the boring ones, but I wanted to start with them to like get to grips with the basics, and then I'd appreciate the more different ones. But actually, I should have started with the more different ones. So previously I talked about, I played as the crazy cult who can't make new cities, but all they can do is persuade the minor factions to join them, and then all you get is just a load of tiny little villages that constantly generate free troops and nothing else. Hmm. And that worked only because I was playing against one other person, and it was really easy. And then I played as the Peace Lizards, who I was pitted against the other Peace Lizards as the random race.
Surely that works out brilliantly for everybody.
You would think, but apparently they attacked me, one thing. And then I had to make peace with them, but then make peace slightly better than them in order to out-peace them over the course of the game. And then I played as the Necrophages, which were just, they kill everyone. And this time I finally played as the Roving Traders, which are the ones who control the market. And actually, funny enough, I was listening to... we were talking earlier about old episodes, and ended up listening to the "To See a Duck and Know Your Time Has Come" episode, in which Tom Senior talks about Endless Legend because he'd just previewed it. And it sounds like the way he's describing it was the roving clans were supposed to actually be the mechanism by which other people traded, and that without them, no one could trade at all. And so, if you're a warlike faction, you would take them out in order to disrupt the more peaceful factions because they wouldn't be able to trade with each other.
I think a race like that maybe exists in Endless Space.
Oh, right.
Where you literally can destroy that race and now no trade can happen.
Right. So in this, for the Roving Traders, they just get a cut of everything that's traded on the free market, and they also control the free market to the point where they can ban someone from it. So they can just decide, if they don't like you, they can ban you from the free market, and then you can't buy resources. And that's kind of your... that's when you've researched a cool sword and it requires 13 adamantium and you haven't got any adamantium, that's how you get that sword, is you buy some or you trade some of your own resources. That doesn't turn out to be as huge a deal as I'd hoped. I thought I'd have this steady income from all this trade happening, but against the AI, I was playing against two AI races on easy rather than newbie, and The trouble is they barely use the market at all. Like, one of them bought a unit once and one of them bought some iron or something at one point, and that was about it. So you don't get much money from that, and I never bothered to ban anyone from it because it just wouldn't have made any difference. No one would have given a shit. But the roving traders are still really interesting for a bunch of reasons. And I think last time when I talked about the peace lizards, I mentioned that the game's handling of aggression is really interesting because it has a Cold War state where you're allowed to attack each other in neutral territory, but you're not actually at proper war, and you can't... you have to declare war if you want to take anyone's cities or do a proper invasion. And the other interesting thing that I didn't get around to saying last time is that there's a technology called privateers, which for most people is very late in the game. And after you've unlocked that, not only can you hire mercenaries, which you can do pretty much throughout just buying them on the market, but with the privateers tech, you can make it impossible for anyone to know who hired those mercenaries. So you have these units that you can control, but no one else can tell that they're yours. So they just look like neutral units. And then you can do whatever the fuck you like with them, and no one can blame you for it. And that's kind of an awesome mechanic anyway, because you can imagine, particularly in multiplayer, there's a bunch of roving mercenaries and they're suddenly attacking your cities, and you don't know which of the other two players is making that happen. Like, one of them is consciously controlling those units and telling them to do that, and you're like, who benefits most from this? And against AI, it's kind of interesting. And the roving traders can't declare war. So they're even more peaceful than the peace lizards, which makes me wonder why the peace lizards even exist. But the roving traders can't declare war at all, and but they can get that privateers tech. And not only can they get it, but they can get it a generation earlier than everyone else, which is hilarious, because the whole thing only works if no one knows who hired those people. And if your race gets that tech early, it's kind of obvious who they work for. Like, I'm the only person who could possibly have this tech, and so there's all these mercenaries attacking you. So I kind of, that was why I was playing with Zem. I was like, I just want to do this privateers thing. I'm going to make peace and then destroy everyone while at peace with them. And so I did. And obviously I went for like a money heavy approach. I think you start with 3 units, and I kept those. I think I lost one in battle, and so I replaced him with 1 unit, and those are the only military units I ever made. So just the starting ones and 1 other, and I just left them. They went exploring and got some like loot and stuff at first, when the territory has some loot to find, and then they went back to my main city and just kind of sat there and guarded it. And then I just kind of expanded as quick as I could and set up nice, like I think just 3 territories, and just left it at that. And then just concentrated on making a really nice empire with loads of money and expanding within those territories, like getting all the good land and stuff. And then pretty soon I had the privateers tech, like way before anyone else could possibly have it. And then I bought 3 of them, I think. And you have to... I'm like right next to the city that I want to invade. I just want to like just pick on one of my 2 opponents and just wipe them out. And so I have a territory adjacent to theirs, and when you buy a unit, you have to set it what city it should go to. So these units appear in my city, and they have my flag on them. They're clearly my units. You can't make them privateers until they leave your city, but you also have to leave them inside your territory. So after they leave your city, but before they leave your territory, that's when you have to change their flag from clearly mine to who knows? Who knows who those troops are who just walked out of my city and who a minute ago my troops, but now who knows? Could be bought by someone else maybe? Like right in front of the enemy territory, just in open air. Here we go. The privateer brigade who just could work for anyone, who knows? March into his territory and then sack his city. And at that point, I think I was already at peace with both of them, so that's like a step up from Cold War, obviously, where you've agreed not to attack each other. I think we had open borders, we shared map techs, we had research treaties and economic treaties. And as soon as I destroyed their city, I got a message from them and from the other race in the game saying, we've decided we're actually going to revoke your map access. We're just not working out for us for some reason. We feel like the sharing of information maybe hasn't gone to our advantage. And so it's like, I don't know if they know exactly, like, because the AI is in a tough situation where that like they can't really be allowed to guess the way a human player would. Because if a human player guesses, you know it's fair game. Mm. But if an AI player guesses, it's like, well, the AI has access to that information.
Like, the game, do you think they also revoked map access from each other?
Yes, yeah, so that's what I think. I think they do it as soon as there's aggression like that, where neutral factions, neutral units have attacked someone and everyone's at peace. They know something's up, right? Like, even if they didn't know it was me, they would probably just cancel all of their vision sharing techs because that just makes sense. So actually, it was a pretty reasonable thing to do.
But then, yeah, just I was incredibly rich. I just set up my empire to be super profitable. And when I destroyed these cities, I can't remember if you raised them or if you capture them. But anyway, I kept getting richer and richer, and I would just basically buy all of the units that would appear on the free market, all the ones that were any good at all, would just be bought as quickly as they possibly could. And then made basically a series of death balls with them and went around just sacking every enemy city. And got all the way to... the quickest way to win is to take out their capitals. And I'd already taken out the red faction capital, I think it was, and then the green faction with the other ones. And so I needed to... Their capital was really well defended. And to take out a well-defended city, no one death ball will be enough. So you have to siege it, which means you stand outside its walls and just sort of do damage over time. And... obviously they kind of panic at that point and send all their troops to attack you. So their capital was really far away from the other faction's capital. That's where all my privateer units were. So I had to send them across the sea. I had to research a sea crossing technology to do that. And they were going to take a while to get there. I built some new ones in other cities, had them all go to the to outside that enemy city as well. All carefully. Actually, one of them I accidentally sent out to my territory with my flag on, so he had to step back and then take his flag off and then walk out again. You guys probably didn't think anything weird was going on there. And then it seemed like I could probably do it, but this city was really well defended, so I wasn't totally sure if my privateers were enough. So while they're on their way, it's like if they fail, then I've got to hire a whole new batch and then send them again, and the city regenerate in that time. And it could take ages. So just to be sure, I'd like to send my units as well, but I don't want to send my units into their territory. I don't want to declare war in case this doesn't work, and then I still want us to be at peace at the end of this. So if I fuck up taking sacking your capital city and destroying you, then I would like us to still be friends. So I sent my three units out to, like, just the very edge of their territory, just to kind of look the territory. And just like, we're supposed to be, at this time, I'd researched alliances, so we were actual formal allies who were supposed to defend each other. My units just sit on the edge of a territory watching the mercenaries, like, siege and sort of to death. Like, oh, got some problem with the mercenaries there, I see. That's interesting. Let me know how that works out. I might come in at some point. I can't make any promises. Ah, they took it. That's a shame.
At any point did you get the, you know, can't you request tech information from each other as well?
Did
no one at any point go, we'd really like to
have... the privateers.
Yeah, gotcha, it was you.
That's a point, actually. I'm sure that on any trade interface, you can see what techs the other person has that you don't.
Yeah.
So it would be like, as soon as that first time that happens, you just talk to each race and say, can we trade technologies? Oh, no, you don't have anything interesting. Can we trade technologies? No, you don't have anything. Can we trade technologies? Oh, interesting. No, I don't want anything from you.
Can you attack your own mercenaries?
That's a good question.
Be interesting.
That would be interesting if you were playing against other human players and you wanted to, like, create a double bluff. Or
yeah, it'd be interesting if every time you do that, the price of mercenary fee goes up because you get a reputation for killing.
Yeah, don't want to be bought by that guy.
Yeah.
It would be great to do what I did and send all those mercenaries against the enemy capital, then swoop in with their own troops and save them. Like, I'll defeat these evil mercenaries and have the mercenaries run away. Like, yes. Oh no, he's too strong. He's so awesome. It's like, look, dude, you're the only one with this tech. We all know what you're doing.
That's rad. I need to go back and play more of that.
It's a good game.
And the sequel's coming.
Yeah.
Sort of. I don't know if we spoke about that on the pod before.
Yeah, we did. I'm looking forward to it because I've played Dungeons of the Endless a bit, and that wouldn't suit me that well. It was sort of like visually interesting, but I think mechanically there's something frustrating about it. And Endless Space I haven't played, but now that I like Endless Legends so much, maybe I should. But I think maybe I'll just wait for number two.
Endless Space, was good, but Endless Legend is a lot better. And I think that's why it's one of the reasons it's exciting that they've managed to make a sequel to both with one game.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'd be cool.
Shall we questions from questions?
Yes!
I thought you weren't going to respond then, because I didn't say its full name.
I wasn't. JR writes, Dear CNC, re-listening to more recent episodes, there has been discussion of some games made for a particular, usually insular, audience, such as Caves of Cud, Neonstruct, and the like, and I find myself hearing otherwise erudite games journalists and one designer missing a far more interesting point than, is it good? that for all the ill it has wrought, early access has revealed how our understanding of genre in games is flawed, and that we are seeing a genuine solidification of genre in games, possibly for the first time. Genre, as it's expressed in games, usually tries to attach meaning to the viewing angles or controls more than the meat of the game. It may be more appropriate, for example, to associate DayZ with Eve than metastasizing bro cancer that is Call of Duty or Battlefield. Harsh. Equally, Gone Home is a well-acted twin game with a budget, and has more in common with Her Story and the operatic levels of misunderstanding, interpretation, and revelation that make both stand out as great games. And games that are about getting bigger numbers have much more in common with Diablo than Diablo has with the roguelikes that inspired it. I started calling such clicker games lizardemobs, because it's the only part of your brain that works when you play them. To my question then, is this a better, more indicative way of discussing genre in games, and do you have any suggestions of your own? If not, how would you deal with the increasing hyphenation of genre in games? It's an open-world RPG adventure! Sorry for being, for going on, and congrats on Patreon. JR.
Thanks.
So, I mean, I think it's a reasonable point that genre isn't useful. I think everyone would agree with that. That's probably said it. I think, and equally, you know, game mechanics aren't necessarily the best thing to pin genre on because they get traded between games so much, likewise. Perspective or control system. I think, my feeling is that actually the feelings, that moods or atmospheres are actually probably the most, one of the most useful things to found genre around, if you're going to found it around anything. Like, some combination of the payoff for playing the game and the mood it tries to create in you.
Hmm.
So, you know, Diablo is about acquisition and collecting and making numbers get bigger, whereas Dragon Age, which is ostensibly in the same genre, they're both RPGs, by a traditional measure, is about feeling ways about stuff. And none of these are really good phrases, but like Diablo is not about feeling ways about stuff. And if you try and they both have companion systems, for example, but if you try and compare them, you're like, well, this game made me feel ways about stuff and this one didn't, but I wouldn't say one is better than the other because they're both achieving completely separate things, which is to highlight the fact that you can have exactly the same mechanics on the surface, but what matters is the effect. And there are no good words for any of this, and it's the point where you probably give up on having labels at all. But, yeah.
I tend to refer to things after the challenge they present, if they present one, and if they don't, then that's a kind of separate genre in itself. So, like, I never called Gunpoint a platformer, even though it's side-on and contains platforms, and you can jump on those platforms, because that's not the challenge. There's no fall damage, it's not about trying to make jumps, it's not about trying to get to the next platform. So I call it a stealth puzzle game, because the two challenges are avoid the guards and solve the puzzle. And that puts it in the same genre, if I call it a puzzle game, it puts it in the same genre as the Telos Principle, which is first person and looks dramatically different. And to be honest, there's a lot of overlap, I think, in terms of like what happens in your brain when you play those games. Hopefully you're both present you with a set of tools and a problem, and then you just sit there and think about how to use those tools to solve the problem.
I was thinking about this a little bit at Gamescom, because most of the time you go to a games conference and it's obvious what the current trend is, and usually you can pin it down to a genre. You know, it's like, oh, survival games are really big now, or open world single player games are really big now, that kind of thing. Whereas at this Gamescom, it wasn't a particular genre, or at least not one that you could name. It was just a certain bundle of mechanics.
grappling hooks.
Well, but mostly involving having a kind of skill bar where, for one example, Hi-Rez, they make Smite, which is a kind of third-person MOBA-ish type game, announced Paladins, which is a first-person game in which you run around and you shoot people, but as you do so, you level up, and as you level up, you unlock cards, and as you unlock three cards and you pick which one you want, and that one becomes a new skill ability that you put on Q or R.
Oh, I see, like F a hot bar of skills, like, yeah. WoW.
And it's like WoW is telling, because basically all Blizzard games are the same now. Overwatch is the same thing. And what's interesting, though, is that Overwatch, which is about multicultural cliches running about cartoon world, shooting at each other, and can you press the skill bar of buttons, is basically just the same game as Dreadnought. and Dreadnought is Jaeger's game about giant spaceships. Like, specifically, it's pitched at if all the other spaceship games are about being in an X-Wing, then our game is about being inside a Star Destroyer. But actually, it's just the same game as Overwatch. It's about positioning on a battlefield, and then you've got a row of skills, and you press the button, and that means I've gone to Corvette class, and that means I'm all about speed. And so I press this button. And
6, 5, 4, 4, and then maybe 3, 2, and then 5 is usually the best combination of those games. Going away, World of Warcraft experience. That's the answer to those games.
It is. I don't know. I find that I don't particularly enjoy that way of engaging with a game world, whether it is, you know, set in cartoon Russia or whether it's set in deep space.
Those are the two senses.
I don't find, you know, pressing Q for skill ability to play and focus so much on positioning and your character's particular speed and movement abilities and that kind of thing. It is the WoW raidification of all other genres.
Mm.
And obviously it's hugely popular. I don't think it's bad. And I understand why making explicit kind of learning curve for those games where it's not like, you know, Counter-Strike where you're learning, how to aim better, which is a really hard thing to judge the progress of. It's, hey, now I know that that class has this ability. And so in these situations might do this thing. That's a much more defined thing that makes that much more satisfying. But, yeah.
But in identifying that, you're identifying that even though these things have wildly different settings, maybe even control schemes, that they're all the same feel of game, pretty much. Like the satisfaction you get from landing a skill shot is broadly the same thing.
It's the same as Dom says, challenge.
Yeah.
As
well. Somewhere between those three things is an answer, maybe.
Stephen Malone writes, "Hello gents, I recently picked up Nom Nom Galaxy, a delightful game where you travel to other planets, build a little soup factory, and make tasty soups out of the wildlife, all while defending your factory from other hostile soup companies. However, I found the enemies in this game to only be a distraction and a nuisance. All I want to do is build up my base and make lovely little soups, but my flow is constantly being broken by those jerks who just want to break everything. My question is, what otherwise good game would you like to remove the enemies from? Thank you, Stephen Malone."
JP LeBreton recently did a playthrough of Unreal with his own tourism mod that he made, which just removes all the enemies and even damage. So you can like swim through the lava and stuff. And yeah, you just want to look around and look at the architecture. I didn't watch all of it, but the bit I did watch, he just got horribly lost and then complained about the architecture because it's actually like... the bit he was in was had, I think, not just symmetry, but rotational symmetry. So, like, it had four different wings that all looked basically the same. And that probably looked great as a, from a level designer's point of view from above, and you can see this has this really logical order to it. But as a player, it means when you're in wing 3 of 4, you can't tell the difference between that and wing 2 of 4. And so if you've already tried that door over there in wing 2, you think you've already tried that door over there in wing 4, and that's actually the way you've got to go. So I don't know... I assume the reason he made that mod and the reason he was doing it is because he likes the architecture. In the very small sample I watched, it was mostly critical.
I can't really think of one where I'd have all the enemies removed, but I definitely think of most first-person stealth immersive sim things that we like, Deus Ex or Thief or Bioshock or whatever. I would rather have one or two really, really smart enemies than 50 goons. I think that's like Alien Isolation taught me how interesting that can be, and it doesn't have to be, I mean, a single or powerful enemy. I mean, I just like, I think the idea of breaking into a place and being, you know, chased around by one pretty intelligent watchman is more interesting than memorizing the movement patterns of 15 guards who subsequently hide behind boxes. Like, I don't think I've seen that fantasy sold that way, but like, that, you know, the Deus Ex where there are three people guarding a building, but they're all as smart as the alien in Isolation in their ability to look for you and learn patterns and stuff, I think. And where combat isn't really the answer because you then make them super... Because, I mean, there's so much abstraction when you're dealing with that many guards that death only means a certain amount in terms of what bodies mean, and unconsciousness usually, we've spoken about this before, means quite extraordinarily little because it's the same as being dead, but morally better. You know, that's the kind of, you know, thing where everything had huge consequences, but you made it playable by having two guys that you had to worry about, basically.
I think we talked before about wanting Creative Assembly to do Die Hard Isolation.
Yeah.
Where you are the bad guys essentially trying to break into and rob the building, but Bruce Willis is in the vents.
The Bruce Willis alien.
Screeing and pouncing on people.
He's just got a motion sensor and a flamethrower.
To shoo him off with. He's immune to it. Shoo, Bruce Willis, shoo.
Would be his voice in this.
He rushes into the room, checks the lockers, and put you not in there. Wanders off,
sniffs the air, sniffs the air, and prowls away.
You can watch him like taping the sign to the guy in the elevator before he sits down.
His long prehensile tail whipping around the corner. The Bruce Willis inside his mouth.
It's his son from the fifth Die Hard film. Comes out of his mouth.
Yeah, that's actually scarier than Alien Isolation. At this point,
my answer to this would be almost every MMO I've played, and in fact, in World of Warcraft, I absolutely love that world, and I'm so excited to explore it. But didn't particularly love the combat early on. It was fine because it was just over quickly, but then once it started to get harder, just got really tedious. And so, I actually, when Burning Crusade came out, I made a blood elf and just killed myself. And when you're a ghost, if you don't go back to your body, you can just keep on walking around the world, and you're immune. You can't be hurt, but also, I think like around the area you died, you sort of see the action still going on, but then as you go further from it, nothing else spawns. So you end up walking around this world that's basically empty. Like, you can see some things, but I think you don't see other players, or you don't see certain types of enemies, because it's really empty. And the only reason not to do that is it puts this really horrible, strong filter where everything's blue and black and it's kind of blurry and misty, but actually in the graphics options you can turn that off. So I disabled all the death effects and then just walked around the world completely impervious to harm. And I remember it getting like the desertion of the world got weirder and weirder the longer I played, because I played for hours. I just kind of explored the whole world, really. I think I might have one time I tried swimming away from Teldrassil, which is the Night Elf world, but I think that was a different playthrough. And this time I was just kind of... The Blood Elf area, I think, is really near to some very high-level areas that I never would have been able to go into before. And I was just walking through them, and it was getting sort of more and more empty as I explored. But also, the places are amazing. And, in fact, one of the places I discovered was a real, like, fanboy thrill, because it was an undead area, but it looked just like an undead base from Warcraft 3, and I recognised every building. Like, I know what that ziggurat does, and I know what that is like. And, yeah, it was a proper, like, Warcraft lore moment. And, yeah, I explored, like, 5 or 6 whole regions like that, just with no combat and nothing. It was great.
There are a bunch of City of Heroes revival projects, because that MMO closed down, so it's unplayable now. One of them isn't bringing back gameplay, so not quests or enemies. It's running now, and it's running basically just as a chat client, but you can go visit the city and travel around it and stuff like that, but there's no enemies or anything to do. It also has the character creator, so you can recreate your hero, or you can create a brand new one. What it doesn't yet have is it doesn't have the movement powers, so if you were like all about grappling or leaping over skyscrapers or anything, you can't do that yet, but that is one thing that they're planning and adding. I quite like that idea of just touring around that place.
That's amazing.
As a superhero with no enemies.
It's an amazing narrative for like this city that is completely plagued by crime, and then just like 10,000 heroes showed up and they just beat the shit out of everything and just did every possible quest, and then all just went silent for a while, and then when it came back, crime's just gone and there are like 5 heroes left, and they're just talking about the old days.
They've forgotten how to fly.
Yeah, they've lost their powers. They're getting old now, so they can't really do super jumping anymore, but...
The game I would remove enemies from, or at least put enemies on a button so they didn't turn up until you pressed that button, would be Red Alert. A Clan of Conquer Red Alert. Because I always really like turtling in real-time strategy games, and the combination of buildings, walls, pillboxes, and Tesla coils make it really satisfying to build bases in that game. And I used to play a lot in skirmishes against other humans and against the AI, and it was always frustrating when I'd be building my intricate three-layer walls with Tesla spread throughout it, and the fucking enemies would show up. Not ready yet. Go away. So I'd remove the enemies from that, or allow me to trigger it when I was ready.
Have you tried tower defense?
Yeah, but it's not the same. Because it's particular to, I think, the kinds of buildings and tools that you're given to build with. And tower defense games tend not to give you the same broad selection of tools to play with that, say, a Red Alert game did. I'm going to mispronounce this name now. Zhao, or Zhu, writes, "Hello, Rights and Robars. The questioner from last week talked about how he or she felt guilty at not playing endlessly the games they already own. Similarly, the developers of XCOM 2 talked about how their goal with the game was to make sure players see something new with each time they play a game. But personally, I have much happier memories of games where I can play, conclusively finish, and then put away knowing that I've done everything. Which made me wonder, why has the games industry developed this idea that replayability is so important? If I want to buy a game, play it once, and then buy a new game, then I am spending more of my money on more games. Wouldn't it make more sense for developers to encourage players to move on to new games instead of endlessly replaying the same game over and over again, perhaps even beyond the point at which the game has ceased to be fun? What do the panel think? Is replayability really that important? Thanks for the podcast. Zhao."
It's because we don't want you to get... We don't want you to be ready to buy a new game until we've made the next game, which takes about 2 years. So we need that game to last you 2 years, and then by the time you finish that, then we'll have a new one ready. But otherwise, you're just finishing our game and buying someone else's, so we don't want that. We'd much rather everyone else failed.
I think there's some truth in wanting you to be playing that game for the next 2 years, or at the very least wanting you to be able to do that, and... Ubisoft games get derided a lot for the collectibles that are in them. The fact that every game they come out is like, you can collect the 200 feathers or whatever. And that stuff can be super tedious, but I always think about the person who only gets 2 games a year. Because there was a time in my life where I more or less was that person. Mm. And so if there is just more stuff to do in that world, I'm happy about it, basically, at that point.
Yeah, I think there's, with open world games in particular, now that so many different types of gamers have glommed onto them and come to like them and want different things from them, now you have to cater to all of them, otherwise that group of gamers who want collectibles or that group of gamers who want the parachuting challenge in Just Cause 3 for some reason, they will react negatively when you don't have that, and then that can turn into, oh, it's just a bad game. Even though most of the people hearing that will actually not want those things anyway. And also, I think particularly it's a thing with franchises. You want, once you have the next one ready, you want that last game to have meant so much to that person, for them to have had so much time with it and to have such a strong personal attachment to it. Like, that was years of my life. I won't have to get the next one.
There's something to be said for a sense of value allowing games to continue to be expensive as well. I mean, you see it going the opposite way with lower price points becoming more common, making shorter form games more viable for everybody, but it's because, you know, publishers still have like a vague sense of a minimum offering that's necessary in order to be able to charge full price for a game. And certainly games are too expensive, so from that point of view, you kind of want games to offer replay value or something, because you're investing quite a lot more in them than you would a traditional one-shot experience.
Yeah.
But I suspect it makes sense from a publisher point of view as well, not only because then you'll be playing their game until their next game is out, but because then you'll come away from having spent £40 on their game with a sense that that was worth it, that you got, you know, a lot of time out of it in whatever way that was, whether that's collectibles or procedural generation of some kind or whatever, different endings, like some reason to keep going back to a thing and investing in it.
I quite like games as well when I know that there's things that I haven't seen or didn't see, because I mix my playthrough in some way unique. Mm. But like, the parts of the game that I did see in certain kinds of games become more valuable because I know that other people didn't see them.
Yeah.
I imagine that's what Firaxis are aiming for with XCOM 2. A game that has procedural levels and is systemic in most ways. And it's very much about the anecdotes you share with your friends about the thing that happened to you.
Mm.
Yeah, personally, I want games that... I want games where I can get to the good stuff quickly, so I find out whether I'm going to like it or not, and I'm not expected to sink hours and hours to get to anything good. But if I do like it, I want it to last forever, because it's actually quite rare for me to really like a game. Like, it's quite... there aren't that many that come along that often, so when I find one, I want to just keep playing that for a very long time. And if it's a finite experience that just ends in, like, a couple of hours, then that's a shame, because I kind of want to keep playing it. I mean, I released a game that you can complete in a few hours, and everyone complained it was too short. So that's why we make them endless.
And that's all the time for questions we have.
You can send us questions at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. You can write them on our forum at crateandcrowbar.com/forum. You can tweet them at us. We're at crateandcrowbar on Twitter. And you can follow us individually. I am at Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-C-T.
I am at Gonnas, G-O-N-N-A-S.
And I'm C. Thurston, that's at C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N.
That's listening, everybody!
No, thank you, Tom.
I feel like it's quite common that I do it and no one else joins in.
I think everyone listens for, like, the lead, or whatever style of sensualism is going to be, and then you're a fan of the quickie, so...
to get over with, yeah.
Yeah, to such an extent that by the time you finish, everyone else is just thinking about whether they'll start.